Hey, Christy, thank you for joining me to talk about platform building. I know that this is a passion of you for authors and entrepreneurs, and something that you have also done on your own as the author of Saturday Millionaires, a book about college football, right?
Yes. When I got my first book deal, which was actually for a different book that still to this day has not been released from the publishing house, they said, okay, you need to go build a platform. And I was like, oh, what? Because I was a practicing attorney at the time and I had no concept of what that meant or how to do it. And quite frankly, they did not give me a lot of guidance on what that looked like. So it was a lot of trial and error in the beginning.
Yeah. I'm not sure that, you know, even the publishers know. They know that they want you to have a platform, but I'm not sure they totally know how to define it.
Exactly. Agreed.
Yeah. Which is an interesting issue. So, this is fascinating because you went from being an attorney to what you're doing now, which is helping other authors and entrepreneurs build their platforms. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, it was sort of a weird transition in that I was an attorney and I did get this book deal while practicing law for a book that was based around legal issues and sports, and started building my platform to support that book. But what that actually ended up doing was exposing me more and more in the sports law and sports business space, and eventually led to ESPN coming and hiring me away from my law firm to stop practicing law. And I did that for a while and got to be on the journalism side of things and just had more and more friends coming to me saying, wait, how did you get on that show? Or, you know, how did you get to write the book? Or how are you writing for this website? And I started helping people for free. And then came to a point in my career where it made sense for me to figure out how to monetize all that knowledge. So I always say I was my own best case study and I use myself for a lot of trial and error, but I only use the proven stuff for the clients.
Right. You're not making them learn all the hard things that didn't work.
No. I try to let them learn from my mistakes along the way.
Yeah. So you are still doing this. You still have this platform as someone who speaks and writes about sports, legal, business, right? You have a Twitter handle,
Sports Biz Miss. So that was I had a different Twitter handle when I first started. I mostly wrote and talked about baseball. And so it was a baseball centric username that I had. And then as I started doing more and more media, I think it was actually someone at Comcast Sports Southeast, which was a regional sports network, who helped me come up with this sports business idea and taught me a lot about branding, not only my social media handles, but like I got a logo created that goes along with it. And he, along with some others I surrounded myself with, really taught me the value of creating a personal brand. And for me, really leaning into the fact that I was female in a very male dominated space and using it to my advantage instead of focusing on the ways in which being a woman in a male dominated industry might be a bad thing. I had some great people around me who really taught me how to turn it into a positive and make it easier for me to get noticed because I stood out from all the, you know, middle-aged white men that I was up against sometimes.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, sports fans, you know, there are plenty of women sports fans. It just is, you know, you can take what's different and either be a victim of it or use it in your story and move forward, which is what you did, which is great. And, you know, a theme comes up, the view that comes up with so many of the authors I talked to who were like, you know, these things, someone reached out. There's like this almost accidental platform building. It's not accidental. It happens because of the work that you've done and the way you put yourself forward, but it doesn't always happen because of entirely everything that you planned and charted out, right?
Right. Right. I mean, my plan was to be a corporate attorney and be doing mergers and acquisitions the rest of my career. And I haven't practiced law now in 9 years. So did not go according to plan at all, but I love what I'm doing now, obviously even more than the plan I thought I was going to enjoy.
Right. Right. That's great. So, so you got the book deal. So tell me how the book fits into that platform building.
Yeah. So it was a little unusual how I got my book deal in that I was practicing law and there was an attorney at my firm who owned a sort of niche publication in the sports space. And some of the people at the firm knew that in law school, I had written a legal journal article that was published in a legal journal about collective bargaining in Major League Baseball. Fascinating to me, but not to anyone else. And it got passed around to this editor of the publication that a partner at my firm ran. And he was like, hey, if you ever want to write for, you know, our publication, feel free. And I thought, I'm a first year associate working like 12 to 14 hour days. When am I going to sit down and write about baseball. However, the market crashed not long thereafter, and the type of law I was doing at the time was heavily affected by the market. And somehow the editor at this niche publication knew an editor at a publishing house and passed along my legal journal article just because he thought it was interesting. And the publisher actually contacted me and asked me to put together a book proposal. And I got my first book deal that way. It was for an academic publisher. We have run into some timing issues with the release. I am still technically under contract for that book 10 years later, but it has never come to fruition. So in the meantime, I came up with another book idea, got a literary agent, got a book deal from a different publisher for that book, and it has already come out now years ago. So it's sort of interesting that my first book actually still is not out yet, but my second book is out.
Right. Publishing. You gotta love it.
I know, right?
So, and then, you know, you've come to doing television appearances, you write on ESPN, you talked about that, you write on Forbes. I mean, you are still very much a presence in your area. So yeah. How did that, you know, clearly you made the shift from practicing law to doing this.
Yeah. And one of the things when I look back that I think was really important and allowed me to make that shift from practicing law to really building that brand and moving on and getting the second book deal and getting the ESPN job and all the speaking and consulting I do now is I started out writing just about baseball, but then I got brought on as a contributor at Forbes, which was, again, sort of a random thing that happened to me with an editor that I emailed about something else and ended up asking me to contribute. And as I wrote more there, I was writing about legal and business issues all across sports. And in early 2011, around May or April, I decided to go all in on the business of college sports. Those pieces were getting the most views. And even though at the time, I probably wouldn't have said that was what my favorite thing to write about was, probably at that time, baseball was my favorite thing. For anybody who's ever blogged knows that when you're blogging and you feel like no one is reading, it's really hard to stay motivated. So even if you love the subject, it is really hard to continue to put out content when you're shouting into the void. Well, what happened is that I started writing these pieces about the business of college sports, and I wasn't shouting into the void anymore. People were reading, they were leaving comments, they were emailing me. My social media was growing. I was getting opportunities to be interviewed on TV and radio. And I thought, I found something here. Yeah. It's amazing how much more you can enjoy a subject when it's getting attention and people are reading it and you're getting that positive feedback. And so in May or April of that year, I decided to go all in on focusing on college sports, particularly college football, but the business of college sports. And so that was May or April. By August, I had my book deal. And in October, I got the deal from ESPN to leave the practice of law. And so I talk a lot to bloggers about, should you be more niche? Should you be more broad? And I think people get really stuck on trying to develop a niche from like the day they decide to blog. And I think you got to give it a little space to develop and figure out not only what do you enjoy and what do you have the expertise to talk about, but what do people want to hear more about? Where is there a gap in the marketplace for your knowledge? And at that time, there was this real gap in understanding how the business of college sports worked. That was almost a decade ago, and that has really changed. And a lot of reporters write about it now, but at the time, no one did. And so I had been writing about all sports for probably 2 years at that point. And it was when I niched down and I found that sweet spot between my experience and what the audience wanted that everything just suddenly took off for me. And so when I look back, like that was a real turning point, was when I niched down. I just think sometimes people do it too soon. Yeah. You gotta test the waters a little bit.
Yeah. So it's almost like, and because you hear that there's that constant dichotomy between people, first of all, they're afraid to niche down because they think they'll be less relevant or miss opportunities. Yeah. And they don't want to get bored, you know. But it's almost like it's not that you just pick a niche and go for it. You almost let the market tell you what your niche is. That's the key. And to do that, you have to be a little bit broader and be putting things out there and creating content.
Right.
I
wrote what I thought was one piece for Forbes about the business of college sports. And then it did so well. My editor said, well, I did it on one conference. And he said, what if you did this for all five or six of the major conferences? And I said, okay. So then I wrote those and then they did so well. It was like, okay, we've got something here. Maybe we should be writing more about this. Yeah. And so, you know, it wasn't something that was planned. It just sort of happened. But like I said, when you start getting that positive feedback and your audience is growing, that's when you sort of know it's time to lean into that. And now I've been leaning into it for 10 years and ended up getting me another book deal. I 100% believe it's the reason I ended up at ESPN, because they were linking to my pieces all the time. And that's sort of how their higher ups learned about me and found me and hired me away from practicing law. And almost all of my paid speaking and consulting is on the business of sports, even though I now run a PR agency and have sort of moved on in my career in that sense. I do still write for Forbes and I do still do television work for ESPN some. And I worked so hard to get my foot in the door in that industry. I'm not willing to, you know, let the door shut behind me. I want to stay in. Yeah. And everything I learn as a journalist really pays off for my PR clients. So although I sometimes feel like I have two lives, they really feed each other well.
Right. Well, the one is almost a sandbox for your journalism and publicity intelligence is what you're doing in your own. That's very interesting. Yeah, that's great. I mean, because I think people are afraid to pick a niche, fearing they're going to be boxed in. It's like, what if I get bored? I have to do this the rest of my career.
With my PR agency, like most of our marketing is geared towards females. And I talk all the time about how part of the mission and the motivation behind the PR agency was that I read this stat that only 19% of experts featured in the media are women. And I was shocked because I had been in the media. So it hadn't really occurred to me that there was this like, you know, overabundance of male experts on air. Although, you know, if I stopped to think about it, I knew that even just based on what I saw in the sports world. And so almost all of our messaging is geared towards women. However, we serve male clients and we still get male clients in the door every single month. And they don't care that we're largely marketing to women, you know, because what they care about is that we get results and they don't really care if it's for a male, a female, a dog, a chimp, an alien, you know, they just care that we get results. But women, we have to speak to a little bit differently to get them in the door as clients. So even though it looks like we niche down in our marketing message, we still get other types of clients in the door. And that was an interesting lesson to learn as a business owner, because I was really afraid. I did not want to only work with women. I just wanted to like 75% work with women. And it's always really scary to niche down, but every time I've done it, it's worked out really well. So I try to now use that past success to sort of inform my decisions going forward.
Right. Well, so you were, you know, you're niching down on your audience. And I think that makes you able to speak more authentically to them. And, you know, you obviously bring your passion about it and serve them really well. And then that does, you know, I think it's weird, but to get a bigger impact, you have to go more narrow, which is just so counterintuitive to most people, this balance. That's great. So you work now with authors and you work with entrepreneurs and other people who are trying to get to do the same, to step into a space of authority, of expertise.
Yes.
I'm trying to reach some of those same people here as I'm working on my next book. So, you know, obviously everybody's going to build their platform differently. Everyone's going to approach this differently, but there's some general advice that you give people as they approach this. If you're sitting there saying, you know, who am I to do this? How do I start building my platform?
So the first kind of exercise that I do with a client that comes in, regardless of whether they're in our, you know, full support retainer package, or if they're somebody who's in our group program, I always tell them how important it is to know what you want your personal brand to be, because we all have one already. It's whatever other people think we do or what we're about or what's important to us. And sometimes if you start asking around, it's really interesting to hear what people think you do or what you're passionate about. I remember when I was practicing law, my final year practicing, I was at a sports law conference, and that was not the area of law I practiced. I did commercial real estate and mergers and acquisitions and securities. But I went to the sports law conference because I was a big sports fan and I was writing about sports. And I sat next to a guy at lunch and we had talked all day about all these sports issues and whatever, but he knew what I practiced. And he said to me at the end of the day, he said, if I come back to this next year and I see you and you're still practicing law, I'm going to be really disappointed in you. I was like, what are you talking about? But you know, he saw it before I saw it, how passionate I was and how much I lit up talking about sports. I was still stuck in the mindset I was going to be an attorney. I wasn't looking for a job outside of law, but he saw it before I did. And so I always encourage my clients, ask your followers or your clients or your friends and family, you know, what they think that you are best at or what they think you're most passionate about. And one of the exercises I was taught was when somebody introduces you, especially in a professional setting, pay attention to what the third thing they say about you. The first thing's going to be your name. The second thing's probably going to be your job title or something like that. What is the third thing they say about you? And for me, even when I was a practicing attorney, it was, you know, this is Christy Dosh. She's one of our associates. She's a huge sports fan, or something sports related was really that third thing. And so I've told people sort of pay attention to that third thing. And then as they become clients, we tell them, okay, whatever that brand is, whether it's what you want it to be or not, we can intentionally craft your personal brand. And the way we teach clients to do that is we tell them that they get three buckets. They get three things they want to be known for. I have sometimes allowed a client to stretch to four, but one of the first clients I did this exercise with, I didn't put a limit and she came back with 10 buckets and said, people are going to be so confused by what you do. They're going to have no idea what you do. And so I work with clients to come up with their three content buckets or the three things they want to be known for. And then anything they do that is forward facing, which is what we always called it at ESPN. So I just got in the habit of saying that. Anything the public can see, a blog post, a speech, a podcast interview, a social media post, whatever, anything the public can see, it has to fit in one of those buckets. And if it doesn't, you shouldn't be talking about it publicly. And I caught myself early on when I was trying to grow my business, I would be in Facebook groups and I would see somebody ask for advice about whether they should form an LLC. And I wanted to jump in and answer because I'm an attorney and I know the answer and I want to be helpful. But then they think I want clients as an attorney, and that's not what I want. I had a PR agency. And so now I always stop and ask myself, like, should I be the person to answer this question? Even if I know the answer, should I be the one to answer it? And I tried to get in the habit of the way I can be helpful is not to give the answer. It's to tag in a friend who that is what they do. So tag in an attorney friend who does want more entrepreneur clients instead of me giving the answer. And so I did this three bucket exercise for myself and decided what my three buckets were going to be. And we sit down with every single client and do it. And I think it helps really streamline your messaging, particularly when you're out there getting PR, because often people get an opportunity to be interviewed, but they end up in a piece that's about something that has nothing to do with their book or nothing to do with their business. And it's great to say you were on Forbes or wherever it was, but if it doesn't feed into the person you're trying to become, the brand that you're trying to develop, then not that it's wasted effort, but you're confusing your message. You're confusing your personal brand. So the three buckets exercise remains probably my favorite thing to do with clients, because I think it really helps us to start solidifying their brand and making sure we're putting them in front of the right audience and we're getting them the right opportunities to support what it is they want to be known for.
That's great. That's great. You know, it makes me think when I was working with, I spent a lot of years working with corporate clients doing content marketing and writing for them. And most of them would have absolutely zero style guide, you know? And so I'd say, okay, three adjectives. We're going to do the three adjectives and that's your style guide. Everything has to fit, you know, this three adjectives. It's like a little mini version.
That's a good exercise.
You know, it's just like, because you don't get to pick, you know, all of them. If you pick all of them, then you have no voice. You know, so it applies to brand. It applies to voices. Just sort of pick those things and try to live with it. Great advice there. That's really wonderful. Now when I first sent out this request for interviews, you said you had a good Twitter story. So I have to ask about your Twitter story.
So my publisher of my first book said, you have to get on Twitter. And this would have been in 2010, maybe 2009. I can't remember, 9 or 10. And at that point, I knew a few people that were on Twitter, but Twitter was in its early days. And I think people mostly shared like what they were eating for lunch. Yeah. It wasn't anything like it is now. And I thought, why do you want me to get on Twitter? I mean, this is the only advice. Well, I take that back. They told me two things to do to build my platform. They said, start speaking more and get on Twitter. And didn't tell me how to start speaking more or where. And I had to figure that out on my own. And Twitter, I was like, okay, I'll get on Twitter, but like, what do I do with it? And so I started by following other writers that I knew and that I read their work. So it was a lot of other sports writers, particularly writers in baseball. And then sort of as they shared other people's content, I would discover new people to follow, and it kind of built from there. And I was already writing for Forbes at that point. And so I did sort of figure out that I should be sharing the content I was writing for Forbes, and that that would allow me to meet more readers. Actually, I take it back. When I first started on Twitter, I still was on my own blog, and it was actually someone else I connected with, another writer that I connected with on Twitter, who he got invited to contribute for Forbes. So I started reading Forbes more and reading his work. And I ended up reading something by the sports editor, and I emailed him to sort of provide a longer comment on his piece versus posting it on the website. And he ended up inviting me to become a contributor. So that's how I became a contributor at Forbes. But as I built up my following on Twitter, I always joke and say, one day I'm going to write a memoir and the subtitle is going to be something about how Twitter changed my life, because it really is how I made every important connection that changed my career. I met an agent on Twitter who ultimately introduced me to another agent within his agency. And that's the guy who got me to ESPN. And I wasn't even trying to get to ESPN. He called me one day and said, I had a meeting at ESPN today about another client. I brought up your name. They know who you are. And now they want to meet with you. And I said, meet with me about what? Like, a job with ESPN was not even on my radar. Like, that wasn't what I was trying to do with an agent. I was trying to figure out how to publicize my book, and I wanted to like be on TV a little more, but I wasn't trying to change careers at that point. So, you know, that really changed things for me. And then I think using Twitter to position myself as an expert on the business of college sports, and, you know, really using that platform to, build my expertise around that and meet more people in those circles and get my stuff shared by more writers and linked to by other writers. I mean, that ultimately got me the book deal for the book on the business of college sports. It got me to ESPN, you know, it got me the agent. I also met my husband through Twitter. So I always joke and say, like, every big thing that's happened in my professional career has been thanks to Twitter. And it sounds silly, but I really truly believe that Twitter has changed my life, and I will always have a soft spot for Twitter.
That's great. You know, I think people, yeah, do misunderstand it. The thing that I've always found it best for is making connections with people.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it's for, you know, not for whatever else. Yeah.
You can reach people you would otherwise not have access to. I just had a client tell me that she woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning a couple weeks ago. She wasn't our client at the time. She just became our client today. And she said, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I woke up at like 4 o'clock in the morning, and there was this news that, you know, I had something really important to say on. It was right in my wheelhouse. And she said, I don't know how to pitch myself. I knew I was going to get started with a publicist, but at that point she hadn't decided who to hire yet. And she said, I just got on Twitter and I started finding reporters. She does immigration law. And she said, I started finding reporters who wrote about immigration. She said, and I just tweeted at all of them and told them that if they were looking for an expert on this news that just broke, I was available that day. And she ended up getting 4 media interviews from those tweets. And she only has like 100 followers. And so, you know, I found that too in the early days on Twitter. It's not about how big your following is. Whereas I think sometimes on a platform like Instagram, you better have a big following or you're not going to get noticed. But on Twitter, you get access to contact people that you might otherwise not be able to get to by phone or email. The journalists tend to be really active on Twitter. And generally speaking, not just journalists, but people who are on Twitter tend to be really interactive on Twitter. They're not just talking at people. They do tend to reply. And so I've done some of my best networking on Twitter and continue to do so.
Yeah, it's a wonderful resource. Yeah, that's great. It's a great story. Just getting up, it's like, oh, I'll just tell you, I'm an expert source.
I know. And it worked.
That's the kind of stepping up though that, you know, we got to do, which is just awesome. I hope she gave herself a big pat on the back for doing that.
I told her, I was like, because I told her this morning, I said, I want to teach you some hashtags to use on Twitter so that maybe the media will find you. And she said, well, let me tell you what I did. And I was like, oh, like, you get it already.
Bam.
You know, I think there's more she can do. And we talked about strategies for doing that going forward. But it is amazing who you can get in contact with and get an answer from on Twitter. In fact, if I see people aren't reading my emails and it's somebody I know is on Twitter, I will usually tweet at them and that gets a response faster.
Oh, that's brilliant. Oh, I never thought about that. That's very interesting.
Tweets don't get caught in spam. You know, you have a better chance of getting to someone. I benefit now from the fact that I have the little blue check mark thanks to ESPN.
Yeah.
And so that gets you like celebrities and people who have a really big profile. I can still sometimes get a response because I end up in their little verified feed. But mm-hmm. even before I had that, I was amazed at the people I was able to connect with and build a real relationship with on Twitter for years before I ever met them in person. And for some of them, never met them in person.
Yeah. I have had that same experience. That is really wonderful. And to flip it around, when someone, if you've written a book and someone reaches out with a question to you and you respond, they're just like blown away, you know? So you get to make a deeper connection with people who are readers and things too.
Absolutely.
And it's somehow easier to do.
Yeah. You know, it's a neat way that I found out people were reading my book, or like it got picked up in a lot of classrooms. And I had done some of that outreach myself to professors, again, mostly on Twitter. I tweeted for a long time. I was traditionally published. So, you know, from the day I got the book deal till the day the book was in my hands was like 2.5, almost 3 years. So there was a long time to talk about the book before it came out. And I had all along the way known that there were these sport finance classes in universities that it would be great for. And I did some direct outreach to professors, but I also every so often on Twitter would say, if you teach in a sports management program, I'd love to get you an advanced copy of my book and talk about how you could use it in your classroom. And what would happen was, you know, it's not necessarily that there were that many who followed me. I mean, there were some, but people would retweet it and it would get in front of the right people. And I would use hashtags that I knew, like the industry association that's for sports management professors, you know, I would tweet using their hashtag. And so it was getting in front of people. And I thought I knew how many classrooms were using my book. I thought I had been tracking it pretty closely with the people I had had direct contact with. But then the coolest thing the first couple of years the book was out was that students would tweet at me and say, I'm reading your book for my class. And I would look at their profile and I would see where they went to school and be like, wait a second, that school's not on my list. And so there were actually a lot of professors using it who didn't come to me and say, hey, I'm going to use your book. And so Twitter was really neat because I was able to connect with so many people that were reading it and reaching out to me and asking follow-up questions or asking for updated information about something that was in the book. And that book came out almost 7 years ago now, and I still get tweets about it every single week. And I still do speaking and consulting based on what was in that book every single month for seven years. So people always say, are you going to write another one? I'm like, I don't need to yet.
Why? I'm still writing this one. That's great. Such great. I'm going to go up my Twitter game. So no, you have so much great advice. That's really wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. I'm going to share with this conversation. I'll share your link to not only your book, but to your site, your agency, which is
Guide My Brand.
Fine, right. Guide My Brand. Yeah. Exactly.
Which, you know, it's interesting. Like the Guide My Brand Twitter, I haven't spent nearly as much time with. I'm on Twitter every day, but I'm really servicing that sports account because, you know, I have 34,000 followers there versus like, I don't know, 300 or something on our agency account. And it's interesting because I have not found it as useful from the agency perspective in terms of getting in front of potential clients. Now, some of that's my own fault because it's not where I've invested my time and effort. But it's still a great way to reach out to journalists. I can reach out on there after I've pitched and, you know, I know they haven't opened the email because I have email trackers. And I can find out that it turned, you know, ended up in spam, or even I can tweet out about a client. And if I use hashtags around that client's industry, like we had one recently who was a retired EMT. And when all of the, coronavirus stuff was first starting out, she had traveled all over the world in the past to work on epidemics and had this like frontline knowledge of handling epidemics, but she didn't even have a Twitter account. And I got on Twitter one day, and I did do it for my sports account where I have a bigger following, but I got on and said, if anyone needs an expert, I've got an expert medical source. She's a former EMT. She's worked on epidemics. Let me know and I'll get you in touch with her. And I forget, I think I used a pandemic hashtag and maybe a COVID-19 hashtag. And I had 3 or 4 reporters who reached out to me and wanted to be put in touch with her. Only one of those ended up turning into coverage for her. But still, you know, the quick easy access to journalists on Twitter is just amazing because they all use it. Even when I talk to clients and they're like, oh, nobody in my industry uses Twitter. That's fine. But people in the journalism industry use it. So
right. That's great. Thanks for sharing this advice. It's really wonderful. I'm sure this could be helpful to a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. I love to talk about it. I could sit and talk about it all day. So
I know, me too. All right.